so I am here with Julie Oringer, who is most recently the author of The Invisible Bridge, and I have just discovered used to live blocks away from me in San Francisco. Julie, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm enjoying my iced coffee on a really hot day in early May.
Yeah, we're blustery here. Well, I wanted to start with a general question, because general places are good to start, and we'll get into the nitty-gritty in just a bit, but you declare in the acknowledgments that this book owes its existence to your grandparents, Andrew and Irene Tiber. And I know that your grandfather also lost his student visa and had to return to Hungary.
That's right.
And so my question is if Andrus and Clara are based, as the novel's epilogue suggests, on Andrew and Irene, Andrus and Irene, to what degree did you detract from these human stories, and based off of that, if you were drawing so heavily on truth, how does fiction become fiction?
Well, the novel really started with my grandfather's experiences. Just before I went to Paris for the first time in 2000, I learned that he had studied architecture there for a couple of years when he was a young man. And I was really surprised when he told me that, because I had never heard anything about that before. I knew he grew up in Hungary and that he lived in Budapest, and he was a window dresser for Sears Roebuck and Company.
Wow.
But
so there really was window dressing providence here.
Exactly. But the architecture thing I had never heard anything about. And so I started asking him some questions and learned that he had gotten a scholarship to study at the École Spéciale, just like the character in the novel, and had lost his scholarship when Hungary passed a regulation that prohibited money from being sent to Jewish students abroad. And so that seemed like, when I first heard that story, it seemed like a fascinating starting place for a narrative. But that was where the narrative started to diverge from the real life experience. So after I got this character to Paris and got him enrolled in school and lost him his scholarship and had him figure out a way to get it back again, then I started thinking about how the book was going to become its own story, independent from the story of my own family. Because, you know, as is the experience of many fiction writers, I think, who are moving from real-life experience to a novel, life doesn't always follow the contours that would be satisfying to readers. And so I did want my character to fall in love. I thought it was pretty likely that a guy in his early 20s would fall in love at some point in Paris in the midst of this like very sort of charged and romantic 1930s environment. But it surprised me utterly to discover that he was going to fall in love with a woman who was 9 years older than he was, and a ballet teacher, former dancer. This has nothing to do with my family's experience at all. This is complete fabrication.
Yeah.
And that this was a relationship that was going to continue and follow him for the rest of his life.
What attracted you to ballet as a kind of instructor, as a character for Clara?
I grew up studying ballet, and I had one teacher when I was a kid in New Orleans who had this very beautiful French accent, and who corrected us very strictly.
Uh-huh.
And always seemed mysterious to me. She always seemed to me like somebody who might well have a shadowy past or fascinating stories to tell. And I thought about her all my life. I never really imagined that she would become a character in any piece of fiction that I wrote. But I think somewhere in my mind, she was the inspiration for
so
this character.
So you basically had Paris. You just needed the love interest, and you thought and immediately conjured up the most prominent French personage in your head. That's what happened?
I think that was more or less what it was, although it felt a little messier than that. And what really surprised me was that that it was Clara and not her daughter who Andras ended up falling in love with. Clara has a 16-year-old daughter in the book, and Andras is introduced to her through a mutual friend. And when I got them in the scene together, it kind of seemed so boring to me to have Andras falling in love with this 16-year-old girl. And I thought, wow, her mother is actually this fascinating woman. And very young, in fact, because she had her daughter when she was only 15. And I thought, I bet somebody like Andras would fall in love with this more interesting and more experienced woman.
So the suggestion I'm getting from this answer is that you didn't really heavily outline this book. Or did you? How did this mammoth story come into play? Because it's designed in such a way where a moment from one chapter lines up neatly into another moment from another chapter, and it's been called old-fashioned by some people. I'll get to that in a bit, but I'm very curious about the design of this, first and foremost.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about that was that the design came from the historical timeline.
Yeah.
I knew what events had to happen when, because of when they had happened during, you know, the run-up to the war and then during the war. But as far as the characters' experiences went, I took a much looser approach when it came to thinking about the structure of the book, because I really didn't know when I began which of the characters I introduced at the beginning were going to become really important to me, how they were going to be important, what the connections between them were going to be. And so within the more organized framework of the history, it gave me a lot of freedom to allow the personal events of the novel to develop more organically.
Interesting. So essentially the timeline itself formed the rigid framework, and you just let the characters bounce around based off of the events that were occurring in both Paris and Hungary.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, too, it was helpful for me to allow the book to develop chronologically.
Yeah.
I did know about some of the experiences that had happened in the characters' past before I actually wrote them in the book. But in a way, writing the story chronologically was like telling it to myself.
Yeah.
And so it brought me back to the desk every day, because I wanted to find out what happened to these people, too.
Did you have an end point always in mind with this, or...?
I did have an end point in mind. I kind of knew who was going to make it through the war and who wasn't. But not entirely. Not entirely. Because as the character relationships developed and became more complicated, I realized that I wanted characters to remain on the scene who I thought I was going to have to say farewell to, and others who I had planned to eliminate early on who persisted in ways that were surprising to me.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, actually, I had some pretty decent mortality rate in terms of survivors, I must say, without giving things away. Anyway, you're balancing a 200,000-word manuscript, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
Yeah. The thing I actually want to talk to you about in terms of revision is I noticed you were very careful to use words like panchromium and circlet and lemniscate.
That one's stolen directly from Nabokov.
Oh, really? Really? Yeah.
From Lake Lemniscate in Lolita.
That's right. And then Laxard, which I think is a neologism on your part.
It is, I'm afraid.
Yeah. But the thing that interested me about the vocabulary in this book is that you were very careful to, one, ensure that you didn't use the same word multiple times, but also use a word that wasn't this ultimate tense center that sticks out like a sore thumb. I want to know how you agonized to get that balance, the lexical balance here.
That's a great question. I'm so glad you're asking me about the language of this book, because that's not something that I've had to think about aloud yet. When Andy Greer and I were at McDowell together a couple years ago, as he was working on his novel Story of a Marriage and I was revising this book, we would sometimes go swimming in the afternoons and trade a list of neologisms that we had, you know, coinages that we had created over the course of the day. And it became a kind of game. But I felt like if there was a kind of a principle behind the language choices that went into this book, I felt like the guide that I followed had something to do with what was actually happening in the narrative. That there were times when a character was in a more reflective moment, or when the action was a bit quieter, or when we really needed to be able to see something slowly and clearly. And those were the moments when I felt like I had a little bit more freedom to allow the language to open up and to become more interesting and maybe even to call more attention to itself in places. And then there are moments in the book where the action is so painful, or the series of events is complicated, or where the events themselves are so emotionally fraught that the language really has to back away and allow the events to speak for themselves. And sometimes it's tough to do that, because sometimes, you know, those are the moments when you really want to draw out some word that you feel is particularly expressive or particularly unusual, but those are also the times, I think, when it's really not about the language. It's really about what's happening to the characters,
yeah,
and when the language sort of wants to be a little bit quieter.
Well, I observed that too, and I'm glad you brought this up, because to me, this almost seems like two books. The Invisible Bridge is between the first half and the second half, in my mind. This first half, which is sort of an elegant, romantic view of Paris, where many of these words that we're talking about manage to flourish, versus the darker, bleaker, straightforward part in Hungary. This leads me to wonder if you were bouncing around between these two halves, whether if you were, as you point out, very language happy or very happy to portray something that was romantic, and here you have to portray something that's particularly bleak and Holocaust related. Or did you bounce around, or was it pretty much beginning to end?
Kind of beginning to end, and in fact it was really important to me. This wasn't something that I knew about the structure of the book beforehand,
yeah,
but I did know that the life that I was creating for Andras Levy in Paris was going to fall apart in the second half of the book. And what surprised me was the fact that in terms of the number of pages, the book is kind of evenly balanced between the setup, the creation, the future-looking part of Andras's life, and the breakdown and the uncertainty and the horror and tragedy of the second part. And I feel like this was so important to my understanding of the experience of the people who were going through these times, that in fact I wanted for the reader to feel with Andras all of his expectation and all of his hopes about the future of his architecture career and the development of the friendships he made at school with other future architects, and the relationship with Clara and its complications, and all of these currents of life that really are drawing him forward. But throughout that whole first section, another movement has to do with the increase in his awareness of the political threat that's building throughout Europe, and there's also the intimation of the approach of a war. And so right around the midpoint of the book, there's this kind of fulcrum at which he loses his scholarship and he has to return to Budapest, and then is conscripted into the labor service. And in a way, I feel like this is the most important thing about the book, to feel all the expectation of the first part, and then to have that juxtaposed with all the disaster of the second part.
You're really alluding to the point near the end of the Departures and Arrivals, where you have those series of rhetorical questions: what if Andras had lived this way? And there's just a list of questions that goes on for almost like a page, split up, you flip over, it's about a page of questions. And it was at that point, it's like, oh wait, all of a sudden the narrative voice, which has been very traditional, suddenly opens up to this flood of questions, and then of course it's the Invisible Bridge.
Do you want me to read that passage? How could he have known it would be his last night as a resident of Paris? What might he have done? How might he have spent those hours if he'd known? Would he have walked the streets all night to fix in his mind their unpredictable angles, their smells, their variances of light? Would he have gone to Rosen's flat and shaken him from sleep, bid him luck with his political struggles and we shall have it? Would he have gone to see Ben Yaakov at his bereft apartment one last time? Would he have gone to Polliner's, crouched at his friend's side and told him what was true, that he loved him as much as he had ever loved a friend, that he owed his life and happiness to him, that he had never felt such exhilaration as when they'd worked together in the studio at night, making something they believed to be daring and good? Would he have taken a last stroll by the Sarah Bernhardt, that sleeping grand dame, its red velvet seats flocked with dust, its corridors empty and quiet, its dressing room still redolent of stage makeup? Would he have crept into Forestier's studio to memorize his catalog of disappearance and illusion? Would he have gone back through the secret door he knew about in the Cimetière de Montparnasse, back to his studio at school, to run his hands along the familiar smooth surface of his drawing table, the groove of the pencil rail, the mechanical pencils themselves with their cross-hatched finger rests, their hard, smooth lead, the satisfying click that signified the end of one unit of work, the beginning of another? would he have gone back to the Rue de Sévigné, his heart's first and last home in Paris, the place where he had glimpsed Clara Morgenstern with a blue vase in her hands, the place where they had first made love, first argued, first spoken of their children? But he didn't know. He knew only that he was right to keep Clara from going with him. He would go, and then he would come back to her. No war could keep him from her, no law or regulation. He rolled himself into the blankets they'd shared and thought about her all night. Beside him on the floor, Tibor slept on a borrowed mattress. There was an unspeakable comfort in the familiar rhythm of his breathing. They might almost have been back in their house in Cognar, both of them home from gymnasium on a weekend, their parents asleep on the other side of the wall, and Matyash dreaming in his little cot.
The question I have for you in relation to that passage, was this a way for you stealing yourself up for this bleak part? All these questions, the sort of laundry list of like, oh my gosh, well, I gotta say goodbye to Paris.
Well, I guess one thing I'm doing in that section is kind of tipping my hand toward the reader. I'm letting the reader know that, in fact, it's not his, you know, it's not what he expects it is, that it's not, he's never coming back to Paris, at least in this manifestation of his life, you know. Before, when you mentioned a sort of shift in the narrative tone there, I think what I'm understanding that you're referring to is the fact that through much of the novel to this point, we're really very much deep in Andras's point of view. And here we're pulling back a little bit and seeing, almost seeing the writer's hand at work to a greater extent, and being led to that other section where, you know, in fact, he's not going to get to make the return that he expects he's going to make. I kind of feel like this was a hard moment for me in writing the book because, like him, I was pretty invested in what was going on in Paris. And in fact, early on when I was writing the book, I thought, you know, this woman he falls in love with obviously can't come back with him to Budapest. This is one of the, you know, one of the problems in their relationship. What are they going to do? You know, they're in love, but because of the things that happened to her when she was young, it's impossible for her to return. She's a fugitive from justice, essentially. And so when we got to that point in the book, and I thought, okay, now it's time to leave Clara behind, part of me was ready for that narratively, and another part said, I don't think we should do that.
I'm glad you brought this up, because this also brings to mind something I noticed in the second part, and that is your tendency to often depict action in a way that really holds the reader's hand. I just want to offer a few examples. Like during General Nagy's motorcade, you describe the tense festivity in their clamor, the way that Lieutenant Havroth silences Goldar with a blow from the butt of his pistol. Now, the fact that you're using an action and you're telling the reader what it signifies is very interesting to me. It obviously fits the needs of the storytelling, but it also makes me wonder whether you wanted to have such an explicit representation of action because you were dealing with a sensitive topic like the Holocaust, or perhaps this was your way of contending with, oh, I'm not in romantic Paris anymore. What about this?
Yeah, well, again, I feel like it's a matter of remaining true to the character's experience. You know, in the first part of the book, you know, Andras himself is pretty innocent. You know, he hasn't been exposed to very much horror in his life until that point. Until what happens later in the book, and so his view is much like, you know, the way we feel when we're 20 years old. You know, he has a sort of more simplified and more romantic view of the world. And later on, as his world descends into a lot of uncertainty and chaos, I think that because of the innocence that he had in the first part of the book, he would be much more sensitive to the sort of physical horror and the moment-by-moment awfulness of what's going on around him. And so it seemed like those would be the things that he would pay attention to and the ways that he would experience them. I think he would have experienced them pretty viscerally.
Well, that's the other aspect I'm curious about. I'm wondering if both this perspective of Andras, in terms of he's in the labor camps, and he is trying to infer from the uniforms or the actions or the sounds what's going on, because there's no news circulating.
Right.
But simultaneously, because during this part of the book, you, Julie, as the author, are very much drawn to those particular details and what they mean. I'm wondering if some of this came about from your own research, like perhaps staring at a photo and trying to understand what particular detail in that photo was. Was there anything along those lines in terms of this audio-visual sensation that occurs in this section of the book? Or?
Yeah, well, there were a lot of things. I mean, what I was surprised by was how many of those sensory details really were available if you went looking for them. I mean, when you're talking about how did I make decisions about what to pay attention to in those environments, especially in the labor camps, you know, some of those details came from talking to people who had been there and the things that they remembered most vividly. Some of them came from looking at photos and archives. Actually, I also went to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, where they have an object archive, in fact. And I looked up Hungarian forced labor camps in that archive, and one of the objects that came up was a backpack that, you know, that a guy who had been conscripted into the labor service had actually carried with him. And you can call from the archives those actual objects. And so I sat there and looked at this backpack and touched the fastenings and the canvas and could even smell it, and there was dirt in the crevices of it. And, you know, I mean, it was really like time travel in a sense.
Yeah. How many objects did you have to touch during the course of writing this book?
Well, actually, you know, what really surprised me when I went to Hungary to do research was just the sheer number of things that hadn't changed. Yeah. You know, the number of buildings that my grandfather described that were still there, and the way certain parts of the town where he went to high school were oriented, and the quality of the light that he described, and even certain smells that he described were pretty similar. So in a way, just being there physically was really helpful. But then another really unexpected source of detail for the labor camps were these newspapers that were written by the guys who had been conscripted. And obviously they were written illegally. Obviously these guys would have been severely punished if anyone had known what they were doing. But nonetheless, they were hand-copied or mimeographed, and they were all scathingly critical of what was going on.
So the snow goose and the biting fly had real life precedence here.
They did, and I didn't know that these things existed until I was in the National Hungarian Jewish Archives, and the archivists started pulling down from the shelves these boxes of newspapers. And I thought, my God, what the hell are these things? I've never heard of anything like this. They were all hand-illustrated. A lot of them were hand-colored.
How were they preserved? Because if they were produced in the same manner that you suggest in this book, they couldn't... The paper was likely to dissolve, or the ink was likely to just dissipate. You
They're
know?
Sitting in a cardboard box in the National Hungarian Jewish Archives in Budapest, and that's the sum total of their preservation. I'm really lucky that they still exist and that the paper didn't completely disintegrate and that they were still legible. But in those pages, these guys who were, you know, living through some of the most horrific months of their lives are totally making light of their experience, of everything, you know, the things that they ate, of the horrible scratchy blankets that they had to, you know, that they put over themselves, of like the bed bugs in their mattresses, of the dearth of water, of the long hours of the work, the calisthenics they had to do, the awful coal plant that they had to sort of feed and tend. And it was pretty clear reading these papers that, you know, this was how people survived, by being at least able to apply the perspective of humor to their experience.
Was there a Ten Commandments that you uncovered?
Or? Yeah, there was a Ten Commandments. It wasn't identical to the Ten Commandments in the book, but there were a few of the Ten Commandments here that came directly from those newspapers.
So for many of the satirical pieces within the book, did you draw from the text of these papers that you discovered? Or?
There were a couple of them that I drew from the paper. There was the one about... taking a vacation to beautiful Ukraine, that came directly. the description of a fashion show at dawn, which has a prediction from this guy, Mangol Béla Kolos, who I guess was like a fashion maven in Budapest at that time. I'd never heard of this guy, but of course, like, there was his name in these newspapers, and so now he's an accurate historical detail. But a lot of them are fabricated, too. And I kind of wonder what effect my translator had upon my understanding of those papers. This guy who I was working
with... Don't say
with,
that. You actually had led me to believe that you read it in the original language.
Oh, I wish I had been able to preserve that illusion.
We can actually delete that part.
Okay. My Hungarian is just about good enough to get me around town, get me to the archive, let me talk to the archivist, but it probably would have taken me a few months with these papers to really understand, and I only had a couple of weeks, and so I was working with this really wonderful translator who was a medical student who happened to be on break from school at that time. I met him through the guy who owned the apartment where I was staying, and he had this very dark, wry sense of humor himself, and so I feel like translating these newspapers with me was the perfect assignment for him in a way, because they seemed almost to be written in the tone in which he thought.
I'm surprised there's no website for these. Is there? I don't know.
Not
there
that
should,
I found.
I mean, this should be preserved in some capacity.
I know, you've
done it through the book. That's a start, you know?
I know. I want for all of these things to be scanned and to be online. They're really amazing visually, too.
Speaking of location, I'm curious. It sounds to me almost as if you had to occupy every single place that you depicted in this book. Would it be safe to say that? And where did you invent a location? What situations did you not necessarily have the convenient backpack to touch with which to draw from to rely upon your imagination?
Yeah, well, in fact, you know, these camps don't exist anymore. Yeah. And so it's
that's true.
So it's impossible to actually go to those places and know those landscapes as they were. I mean, there were a lot of places that I could visit virtually. In fact, one of the locations of those labor camps, Turka, Ukraine, has its own town website, and you can sort of go there and take a virtual tour of the town. And I found this building that had been the orphanage in which, you know, the guys were housed. And you can actually see what the stone of it looked like and things like that. But a lot of that had to be imagined and extrapolated. And then some of the locations are composites of accounts that I read of that time and of those experiences. In fact, even Konyar, the protagonist's hometown, was imagined in the book. My grandfather described it at length to me, and so did his younger brother. But I had never been to that town myself. The farthest east I got in Hungary was Debrecen, which was the town, a larger town, where he went to high school.
I'm curious, is having too much information at your disposal or having too little information at your disposal both an advantage or a liability in terms of reconstructing all these locations and all this topography? But simultaneously, I must also ask, well, scratch the last question because I don't want to throw too much at you. So let's stick with how your relationship between information and creating a location. I think what I wanted to actually ask you about was also how you organized all this stuff that you collected.
Yeah. How did I, of all the information that's available, how to know what's important and what belongs in the book or not? Am I
Yes, absolutely. You got it. That was a very concise way of framing my ramblings. So thank you.
I think that's really one of the toughest parts of this, in a way, because so much has been written about the Holocaust, and so much has been written about Paris in the 30s. And I think the answer to that question always was, what is essential to the developing relationships between the characters and to portraying the events that are going to shape their lives?
Yeah.
You know? There's so much more that I would have liked to include. And in fact, there are two chapters that were cut from the book. One was, and they neither of them were in the point of view character's perspective. One was from the perspective of this young guy, Herschel Greenspan, who in November of 1938 shot a German embassy worker in Paris. And that was the event that precipitated Kristallnacht, or rather that the Nazis sort of parlayed into Kristallnacht.
So it was a cameo appearance that got cut.
That's right. A cameo appearance that involved this guy's background and the state of mind that led him to decide that the only way to protest the deportation of his parents and of a group of 12,000 Jews from Germany at that time was to go to the German embassy and shoot the ambassador. I was fascinated by the fact that this had happened, and the kid was only 17. And so I really wanted to write that from his perspective. But of course, it was totally tangential to the novel. And in fact, in the final version, it's got a much more tangential role. But it went through quite a lot of drafts with that chapter there. And finally, my editor convinced me that it didn't belong in the book. And then there was a short section and then a later chapter that were from the point of view of Hitler, in fact.
Really?
One passage was an account of how Hitler had learned about the experiences, or had learned about the shooting of the German embassy worker and made the decision to say something to Joseph Goebbels that would then precipitate Kristallnacht.
This sounds like a Downfall parody.
Yeah, well, I love Downfall.
You should do that as a book trailer.
I know. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. And then I've been watching those lately.
Yeah,
they're fantastic.
Well, I have to watch them while you can because they're being pulled.
I know. I heard that. And then later on in the book, there was a brief chapter in which Hitler was expressing frustration with Miklos Horthy and his refusal to deport the Jews and these intimations that he might be planning a sort of separate surrender. And it was the moment when Hitler decided that he was going to occupy Hungary and get Horthy out of power, and all of that appeared in the book from Hitler's point of view. And, and those were the only two chapters that were not from the from András and the central characters' points of view. It was so tempting to me because I had the information about what had happened and about what those people might have been thinking and feeling at those times to actually write from their perspectives. But in fact, that ended up not belonging in
the book. But as the Downfall meme has suggested, when you look at any situation now from a second generation standpoint, from Hitler's perspective, it then becomes camp or ridiculous. And was this probably the dilemma you were facing? Or was this, I mean, it sounds like this is a great way to also understand the Nazi perspective, even if it may not have been something you could have, I mean, you almost can't do it in fiction. The last person who tried it, Norman Mailer, it was kind of ridiculous.
Well, you know, what was really interesting was talking to my German editor about this, because she made the argument that to write from Hitler's perspective is fraught enough for American readers, but for German readers, it's completely over the top, that it's just unthinkable. I think that's true for many European readers, in fact. And so it kind of pointed, to me, it sort of pointed to the fact that even for me to have considered this was a reminder of my distance from the material, in fact, and I was really glad to have somebody point that out to me while there was still time to do something about it, you know, because I think you're right. I think that it's so vulnerable to camp, even if you don't, you know, intend it for that, and so I was glad to get those chapters out of the book.
You know, two figures that I didn't see pop up in this book that I had to ask you about that surprised me were, first of all, Hanna Sinesh, who was the freedom fighter and the poet, and Joel Brand, who, of course, helped make sure that the Hungarian Jews didn't make their way to Auschwitz.
I'm curious
why you didn't include them.
Yeah, I think that in the end, the reason is that their stories were not of direct relevance to my characters.
Yeah.
And the way that my characters, that some of my characters were saved from deportation, occurred simply through other means. And there are so many stories of other people who had greatly influential roles in saving hundreds or thousands of Jews from Hungary, who I would have loved to write about in this book, but there just wasn't room for everything that I might have wanted to mention.
I mean, Brad and Sinesh are both indisputably the go-to figures in terms of Hungarian Holocaust history,
right,
which
right.
That's why, I mean, you're very careful to depict other historical moments. That's why I ask.
Right.
I mean, was your strategy here was to essentially just keep the perspective and narrow it down and narrow it down further as the longer we got into the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that really was part of it. And also I think that the sections of the book that take place, particularly at that late stage during, you know, the occupation and then the siege of Budapest, the stories from my family are so fascinating at that point that I felt I wanted to hew a little bit closer to their actual experiences. And in fact, they weren't involved with Brandt or with Senesh. And so, you know, my grandmother, like Clara later on in the book, spent some of the war, spent some of the duration of the siege of Budapest in this International Red Cross shelter that was across the street from the American Embassy. And existence there was such a matter of day-to-day luck. And whatever was happening with these larger scale efforts to save the Jews of Hungary was happening maybe only neighborhoods away, but could have been worlds away as far as these characters were concerned. And then András and his friends and his brothers were often their labor battalions, where the only thing that was keeping them alive was luck and perhaps the goodwill of some officer. And so, in fact, this had to do with really wanting to hew closely to the characters' experiences, as you're suggesting. And then I came across other historical characters who were really fascinating and who I hadn't heard about, who aren't so sort of classically associated with the Hungarian Holocaust, like this guy, Otto Yerezian, who is this doctor who had been, in fact, an Aerocross member himself, had gotten totally disgusted with the party and had quit. And then as the situation got worse and the war approached, he decided that what he wanted to do was to rejoin the Aerocross, the Hungarian Nazi Party, and work from inside to try to save people in this very like intimate and direct manner. And so he set up this hospital right in the center of Budapest during the siege that was ostensibly set up to treat members of the Aerocross and their families, but in fact it was a front, and he saved hundreds of Jewish doctors and their families, and was clandestinely treating the Jews of Budapest. So sometimes it was the more unexpected or less written about figures who really fascinated me in the book.
I wanted to also ask you, the Crooked Rail, I thought immediately of the Brooklyn Rail. And then, of course, there's a list of surnames near the end of the book of those Jewish names who were dead in the Holocaust. And I noticed certain people who, writers who you may know, which seems to be a rather sick joke, but I was curious about this on both of these.
That's really interesting. I mean, the list of names at the end actually was drawn directly from there's a really kind of beautiful memorial in Budapest, a replica of a tree, the leaves of which are inscribed with the names of people who died in the war. And all of the names in that section come directly from that monument. And the fact that some of them are, in fact, the last names of writers I know is completely coincidental.
Okay.
In fact, one that I'm thinking about is Vida, the last name of Vendela Vida,
who's a close
friend of mine, whose father is, in fact, Hungarian.
Yeah.
And, you know, she didn't learn, I think, until relatively recently that she had had sort of more distant relatives who, in fact, were killed in the Holocaust. The crooked rail was a complete invention and has only tangential and coincidental similarities.
I'm curious if the architectural school offered you a great subterfuge with which to school yourself in all manner of architectural terms, as writers often have to when writing mammoth novels.
Yeah,
but also, the interesting thing is, there's that speech about the reinforced concrete that is going to launch 1,000 brutalist architects.
That's right.
Which is actually kind of as horrifying as the Holocaust, if you think about it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, Le Corbusier, who was such a hero to Andras at that time, with some limitations, certainly had a horrifying effect on some of the landscape of New York, for example. But I knew very little about 1930s architecture when I started writing the book. I'd studied architectural history a little bit in high school and in college, and at Cornell, where I went to school, I lived in this residential college for the arts that was right across the bridge from the architecture school, and so about half of our dorm was architects, and so I would stay up all night, you know, as they were finishing their projects and doing their model building, you know, talking to them about their work and about what fascinated them. But I really had to learn a lot about what was going on in 1930s architecture, and the thing that fascinated me most about it, I think, was this dichotomy between the architects who were of the Beaux-Arts art for art's sake school and the École Spéciale, which had a much more kind of democratic and forward-thinking and, in a way, utilitarian view of the art.
And Ferdinand de Lesseps came from that school, too.
Yes, and I was lucky enough to meet a couple of architects who went to the school more recently and, you know, was able to talk to them about their work. And a lot of the practices that my grandfather had described to me, the fact that students of different years studied together and the way the year was structured and the ideological focus of the school are still, in fact, intact and ongoing there. So that was kind of cool. I also happened upon, the first time I was doing research for this book in Paris, this museum of the 1930s that's located in a part of town where some of the most striking and beautiful 1930s architecture exists. It was kind of on the outskirts of town where there was still some land that existed or some buildings that hadn't been sort of grandfathered in and could be taken down for new construction. And that's where you see some of these really remarkable Paré and Pangusson creations.
We talked about the satirical newspapers that were disseminated in the labor camps. What we didn't talk about is the Magyar Jewish Journal.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, like, in 1938, there was the Breslau number 18, which basically severely limited Jewish newspapers. 430 newspapers were completely shut down, and they were ordered to be shut down by early 1939. By 1941, there was hardly a Jewish editor or a reporter left.
That's right.
So I'm curious, given the timeline of this, which the Magyar Jewish Journal is allowed to flourish, and that's also interesting in light of the fact that there was a clash between Magyar and Zionism at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm curious as to where you drew from to get that this particular invention in the book, or was there such a journal that you drew from in this? I mean, how did you account for the press law?
Yeah, well, in fact, there was a Magyar Jewish Journal, and it was one of the only newspapers that was allowed to exist. And the reason that it was allowed to exist is because it was supposed to be a more conservative mouthpiece aimed towards the Jewish community as a kind of tool to tamp down any alarm that they might be experiencing. And so, on the one hand, it was a place where you could still work as a Jewish journalist. In fact, it was one of the only places where you could still work as a Jewish journalist after all these press laws were passed. It was one of the only places where you could get a Jewish perspective on what was happening. But on the other hand, there was an officially sanctioned editorial slant. The only reason it was allowed to exist was because it had an anti-Zionist stance. it was advocating this point of view that suggested that the Hungarian Jewish population was going to make it through the war mostly intact, and that the government was going to help the Jews, and therefore that the Jews needed to help the government. And so the decision to allow that one paper to continue to exist was in fact very deliberate, and that's why it would have been such a such a difficult thing for people of András and Mendel's political caste to work for a paper like that, because of course their experience suggested that things were much, much worse than this paper was suggesting. And the perspective of this paper and the way that it was sort of trying to tamp down any alarmism that would have naturally risen would probably have seemed actually quite dangerous to them. And it was quite dangerous to the Hungarian Jewish community, because I think this was one of the reasons people didn't have a clear idea of what was going on.
When you were sorting through the boxes of underground newspapers, mm-hmm. did you see one that was a little crisper than the norm that might have used a printing press from one of these conservative ones? Or was that a pure invention on your part?
I didn't find the Magyar Jewish Journal. Yeah, yeah, I didn't see examples of that in the box, because all the ones that I was looking at were, you know, these very homemade things. The journal that the newspaper that you're talking about maybe is the one that they created later,
yes.
and they actually had access to, you know, they could print using the, you know, printing press that they had at the newspaper where they were working. I didn't see anything to suggest that. That was a total fabrication, but it seemed like, in light of the fact that there were probably other editors at the Magyar Jewish Journal who were opposed to the editorial stance of the paper, it seemed not unlikely that people might have found a way to use those presses to disseminate some information that was more accurate about what was actually going on. So
I wanted to also ask you about the fact that this novel tends to rely on good fortune, good circumstances, luck, generosity from other characters. András is very fortunate to have a kind teacher. He is very fortunate to meet a man on the train who gets him the job at the theater. In the work camp, he's very fortunate to have this general that permits him to see his wife. And I'm doing my best not to spoil the book, because there's lots of twists and turns. But,
right.
But here's the thing that's interesting. It's like, if the novel here is relying very much on coincidence or circumstance to propel the narrative, you're kind of an opposer, because on one hand, I can totally see why, because if you were a Jew who was lucky enough to survive, yes, it was good luck, it was good fortune, it was coincidence. But on the other hand, if we look to a novel and it relies on coincidence, that could become a problem. What were you thinking about this as you were concocting this narrative, this dilemma between this fiction and reality?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the pleasures that we derive from reading the kinds of rich 19th century or 19th century style novels that were in certain ways the books that I was looking towards most as I was writing this book, coincidence does play a really significant role. And I think that that one of the reasons that sensibility was important to me in a way as I was constructing this narrative is that it's something that my grandparents pay so much attention to in their lives, these convergences that are so meaningful. My grandmother just yesterday was telling me about being at a luncheon at her synagogue at which a certain rabbi who she knows very well was speaking, and he referred to the fact that she was from Hungary, and somebody else came up to her after the lecture and said, "Oh, if you're from Hungary, you should come and talk to my husband. He was born in Hungary, and maybe you know something about where he came from." And her husband said, "Oh, Irene, you know, thanks so much for talking to me about this, but there's no way you would have heard of this little town called Shatoraya Uihe." And my grandmother said, "Well, my father was born there."
Yeah.
"And in fact, I lived there for many years." So it's like, this is the kind of story she loves to tell. And
yeah.
So it was like this kind of story of these stories of unexpected convergence or coincidence that formed so much of the kind of narrative background of my childhood and of like the narrative environment in which I grew up. And so I think part of it is that maybe it's a European Jewish perspective,
yeah.
Maybe it's a particularly Hungarian thing, but that's certainly kind of one of the sensibilities that all of this is coming from.
Yeah.
And then I think the other part of what you were saying is really accurate and really perceptive, and in fact is sort of the whole point of the Wisława Szymborska poem that finishes the book, that the fact that these stories survive at all in large part is due to amazing coincidence, which is just to say that that so many of the occurrences in the world are purely chance occurrences, and it's thanks to those twists of chance or to somebody's mood, to somebody's sense of generosity on a particular day, that somebody survives long enough to actually tell you the story. Now, as a novelist, of course, you also want to balance those chance occurrences with decisions on the character's part, so we don't feel like the narrative is driven by those coincidences, but is sort of augmented by them in a way. So one of the stories that my grandfather told me was that he was in a forced labor battalion working close to Budapest, and it just so happened that this was a battalion that was working at a train yard, and at this train yard they were siphoning goods that were supposed to be sent to the front into the black market. And on a particular day, when the guys were just going about their work, it was suddenly announced to them that they were going to be sent to the Eastern Front. And it happened because, coincidentally, this was the rail yard from which they were shunting goods into the black market. Now, when I was working on the novel, I thought, okay, I don't want this to happen coincidentally. I want there to be some character causality in here. And so I had Andras working at a rail yard like this with his friend Mendel and with Clara's nephew Joseph. But where the deportation was concerned, I thought, I want it to somehow have been his fault. I want his decisions to affect the development of the events of the book here. And so I had Andras and Mendel working on a newspaper that dealt to some extent with the black market activities that were going on at the camp. And so so that was the object that precipitated what in my grandfather's experience had sort of been more of a coincidental happening. So there were times when in fact I manipulated coincidence toward causality for exactly the reason you're talking about.
Yeah. But I mean, you had to come up with a reason every single time, because if coincidence is exactly how these events occurred, and you here are the novelist in a world where when we read a novel, oh, coincidence is bad, it's contrived, it's completely belabored on the fact of the novelist. I mean, what else did you do to just make a coincidence work, or did you stop caring at some point?
Well, one of the challenges of working on a book for 8 years is that you're never at liberty to stop caring. You have to care every moment that you're working on that book for all of the 8 years. And so no, I it was something that I did think about every single time. And fortunately, there were enough situations where coincidence and causality could go hand in hand, or where causality could subvert coincidence, or where the coincidence was to the character's ill instead of to their benefit, that in fact, I felt like I was able to take what is a part of our life experience and contextualize it in the novel in a way that felt more true to life than to some more artificial way of constructing narrative.
Well, I think that's a very good, real way to end the program. But thanks so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Great to chat with you, too. Thanks so much for having me.